The Yoga of Power. 219. 18. Up to Zen. Since our aim has been to give the original doctrine of awakening as it appears from a study of the Pali texts, we have no need to deal in detail with the changes and transformations of Buddhism in later epochs. Besides, this would be more in the province of history than in that of doctrine. We shall confine ourselves, then, to a few short notes. We have already said that Buddhism, in its true essence, is of an eminently aristocratic nature. At the beginning, Buddhism was the truth understood by those few who alone had really achieved illumination and who appeared as bhikkhu or wandering ascetics. Then, around these, the upasaka, lay followers, collected and increased and who, according to the canonical formula, had taken refuge in the Buddha, the doctrine, and the order. The order, however, did not resemble a church and the doctrine still less a religion. Women were originally excluded. The unity of the order was essentially due to a strict style of life. It was only later, and with a decadence fully recognized as such by the ancient texts, that precepts and rules multiplied. The decadence of Buddhism was inevitable once it began to spread, for the Aurya doctrine of awakening is closer than any other to a path of initiation that may be understood and trodden only by the few in whom, together with exceptional strength, there is present a lively aspiration for the unconditioned. And even racial and caste influences played their part. Not for nothing have we insisted on the Aryan quality of the doctrine under discussion. Frontiers to comprehension exist in the normal way, and they are conditioned by the race of spirit and, in part, by the body itself. As soon as Buddhism was adopted by the masses and not only passed to levels where foreign influences survived or were re-aroused, but spread even to peoples of notably different stock, changes and alterations became inevitable. After the original period, the two principal streams of Buddhism have been, as we have said, Hinayana and Mahayana. There is probably more formal purity in the former than in the latter. Hinayana remained the custodian of the canonical Pali 220 texts, which every Buddhist recognizes as scripture, and made them the base of its orthodoxy. But as we said a few pages back, this stream eventually developed a prevalently ethical ascetic interpretation of the doctrine of awakening on a pessimistic and claustral foundation, an interpretation that represented, in fact, a fall in level. Yet Hinayana retained more traces of the clarity, simplicity, and austerity that reflect the original Aryang style. Things went differently in Mahayana, which developed in northern India, Tibet, and Nepal, where the presence of Mongolian elements mixed with even more ancient ethnic strains was noteworthy. Mahayana presents a particularly complex and composite picture, which it is not always easy to analyze. On the one hand, its metaphysical level is undeniably much higher, on the other, cracks and changes in the structure become equally evident. If we look at the negative elements, we must in the first place note that, in Mahayana, the doctrine of awakening from being the heritage of an elite of true ascetics degenerated into a religion with an extensive mythology. Mahayana is aware of the aspects that do not allow the Buddha to be considered simply as a man. Mahayana, in fact, emphasized the cosmic and supernatural significance of the awakened ones and of the bodhisattva who advanced toward awakening. But, on the other hand, it allowed the deification in a religious sense of the Buddha, who here ceases to be one who is liberated and instead becomes a god, the object of a cult and of devout adoration that Brahmanic Hinduism tried to arrogate to itself by making him one of the avatar, the manifestations of Vishnu. In these aspects of Mahayana, feeling and imagination get the better of the purely intellectual and virile principle. As opposed to the Doric bareness of original Buddhism, we have here what is really a fabulous and kaleidoscopic phantasmagoria of thousands of divinities and bodhisattva, of beings who are the mythological personifications of the various states of contemplation, of symbols, worlds, heavens, and marvels. The Buddha becomes a transcendent being in the person of Amitabha, whose name means infinite splendor, and with whom primordial memory is enigmatically associated. Amitabha reigns in the blessed land of the West, Sukhvat, where neither impurity, nor death, nor destruction exist. This has the same traits as those of similar lands in the ancient Aryan Western traditions, in ancient Egypt, and the myth of Gilgamesh itself. These are mythical transpositions of the memory of the original Western, or Northwestern, home of the divine race. One between Amitpa and the world of men stands Avalokiteshvara, with the traits of a divine mediator, the Lord who looks down, moved by love and compassion for all creatures. 1. Compare to our revolt against the modem world. On Sukhvat. Compare to the two Sukhvativihar in Sacred Books of the East, Volume 49. 221. While these creatures are, on the one hand, led along the path of bhakti, of religious devotion, and in some cases Avalokiteshvara even changes sex and becomes a maternal divinity, the Kuan Yin of Chinese Buddhism, on the other, they are each given the quality of body, which is the extra samsaric element capable of producing the miracle of illumination. Not only in each man, but, according to the more popular forms of this faith, since we must now call it a faith, in every living being generally, a potential Buddha had to be seen. And here, naturally, we find a resurgence of particularly virulent forms of reincarnational fantasies that sometimes assume ridiculous shapes as the counterpart of a doctrine of merits. From life to life, by accumulating merits of all descriptions, living beings gradually become awakened ones. They are helped, besides, by the Bodhisattva, who here become semi-celestial beings, losing, at the same time, a large part of their Olympian traits, for, not only are men now no longer left to their own efforts to achieve awakening, as they were in the original austere and virile doctrine, but the Bodhisattva are concerned with universal salvation. They now go to the aid of men, and make a vow not to enter Nirvana themselves until, with their help, all living beings have arrived there too. These doctrines are certainly generous in the equalitarian and, we were almost going to say, Christian sense, but they have little of the Aryan or the really traditional style about them. We no longer have before us the Aryang doctrine of awakening, but a religion put together for the satisfaction of the faith and sentiments of the masses, to the detriment of the knowledge and clear vision that conforms to reality. A second aspect of the degeneration of Buddhism is the philosophical one. Already the later part of the Pali Canon, the Abhidhamma, often shows the same stereotyped, unilive, and rationalistic profile that belongs chiefly to our own medieval scholasticism. In Mahayana, thought certainly has broader play, but it gives place to the misunderstanding we have already discussed. The great merit of Mahayana lies in this, that it has taken as its foundation the point of view, not of a samsaric being, but of an awakened one, not of an ordinary man who strives, but of a Buddha, a Tathagata, not the terminus a quo but the terminus ad quem. That which for the former cannot help being something negative and indefinite, Nirvana, and which Hinayana, too, considered essentially as being evanescently distant, in Mahayana assumes, instead, undeniably positive features. Here is a question not so much of Nirvana as of its counterpart, illumination, prajna, or body. In its highest aspects, Mahayana is certainly a doctrine of illumination, but unfortunately the demon of speculation managed to find a way in. Mahayana often transforms that which, in its nature, is something super-rational and inexpressible, comprehensible only on the basis of a direct transcendent experience, into a speculative concept, and it becomes the organ of a system of thought. The void, sunna, and the intangible tathat con 222. Dense, in spite of themselves, into concepts of spiritual theory of knowledge and of the world. We have, thus, the equivalence, anticipated by many centuries, of Western absolute idealism. Things only exist as creations of the mind. Mind is the original and permanent substance, bhutatathat, intact and identical with itself in any phenomenon. Earthly or celestial apparitions, samsara, men, gods, Buddhas, all originate only in the mind. Mind is like the water of the ocean, phenomena are like the waves that wrinkle its surfaces, mind and phenomena are of the same substance. Outside the mind, nothing has real existence. So we arrive at Ngrunerès system. These ideas, which, as philosophical views, have nothing to do with higher knowledge, contain, nevertheless, a reflection of it, and are thus not without a certain cathartic power. The fall of level that they represent was halted in Mahayana by the presence of a genuine esotericism that was capable, in a restricted circle of qualified individuals, of rectifying such theories and restoring them to the higher plane to which they belong, and also of discovering the secret knowledge hidden behind the mythological form of the various beings and divinities in the religious aspect of Mahayana. This same idealistic, or unrealistic theory, we must admit, was valued less from a theoretical point of view than from a practical one, as it was used as a kind of medicine for the purpose of purification. The misery of beings derives from their taking as reality things that exist only as creations of their mind, deceived by the false appearances of real beings and qualities, and of different natures and values. Action takes them ever further away from true reality, nourishes ignorance, creates ever stronger bonds, and perpetuates the irrational round that the living pursue. One who steeps himself, instead, in the reality of the void, in the unreality of everything that, in heaven or earth, seems objective, leaves his intoxication little by little behind him, feels a loftier calm, detaches himself from action that is due to craving and abandons vulgar interests, hate, and anger. He has now made his mind ready to receive a higher knowledge. It is in this sense that the idealism or unrealism of Mahayana, which possesses not a few points of contact with that of the Vedanta, had, and still has, a cathartic value. In this connection arises the problem of the extent to which a knowledge that, because it refers to transcendent summits, should be inarticulate, while being able, in general, to provide directional suggestions and to encourage moments of illumination. In this very connection, and to end our exposition, we wish to say something about what is known as Zen Buddhism. Zen is one of the most important streams of esoteric Buddhism transplanted into China and Japan and is still in existence. According to tradition, it is actually based on a secret doctrine transmitted from spirit to spirit by Prince Siddhartha to his disciple Markasapa, preserved through an uninterrupted chain of masters. It was carried, at the beginning of the 6th century AD, 223, into China by Bodhidharma, third son of a powerful Brahmin king of southwest India. From China, Zen passed to Japan, where it grew powerful roots and had important developments. We are dealing, in substance, with a branch of Mahayana esotericism, which found, in certain Taoist views, particularly in Lao Tzu's doctrine of the void, and in certain tendencies of the Chinese mind, above all, in its feeling for nature, congenial elements with which it combined. As for the term Zen, it is itself the abbreviation of the Sino-Japanese term that corresponds to the Sanskrit dhyana and to the Pali jhana. But here this term must be understood in a wider sense than we have previously given it. In general, it expresses a form of contemplation developed under the sign of the void. Zen is not, as a few have claimed, a Chinese anomaly of Buddhism. It is essentially a renewal of the exigency that originally gave life to Buddhism in the face of Brahmanic speculation and ritualism. In fact, at one period there had taken place in Buddhism, but using different terms, the same phenomenon of decay, of scholastic formalization and of traditional and ritualistic survival, as in post-Vedic India. Zen appears to have represented a stronger reaction against all this as, in its own time, original Buddhism did against its own background of circumstances. Zen will have nothing to do with speculations, canonical writings, rites, or religious aberrations. It is even positively iconoclastic. It does not, like Ngruna, discuss transcendental truth, but desires to create, through a direct action of the mind on the mind, the conditions for its actual realization. The scriptures are nothing more than useless paper, says Rinzai, a Zen master. Another thus reprimands one who was burning Confucian hooks: you would have done better to have burned the hooks in your mind and your heart, rather than these written in black and white. Texts, dogmas, precepts are so many bonds or so many crutches, to he put aside that one may advance on one's own. The Buddhist canonical literature itself is likened to a window, from which one contemplates the great scene of nature, but to live in this scene you must jump outside the window. There is also the simile of the finger and the moon. To indicate the position of the moon, a finger is necessary, but woe to those who mistake the finger for the moon. We must think the same of transcendental knowledge and achievement. As nature hates a vacuum, it is said, so Zen abhors everything that may come between reality and ourselves. Reap, if you can, the illusions contained in the doctrines, but beware of binding yourself to words and concepts. The idea of a special passing on of the true knowledge independently of the texts is the cornerstone of one of the principal schools of Zen. The state of a Buddha, it is maintained, can only he un. 2. The data and the quotations from texts, in what follows, are taken from Kaiten Nukaria, the religion of the Sumerai. And D. T. Suzuki. Essai sur le Bouddhisme Zen, Paris, 1940. 224. Dersted by one who is himself a Buddha. To describe it in words is a task that would have been beyond the power of the son of the SKY himself. To illustrate the teaching of inward independence, an anecdote is told of a Zen master who, to warm himself one icy morning, chopped to pieces a consecrated statue of the Buddha and put it on the fire with the remark, "The Buddha would have offered not the wood of his statue, but even his very life to help another." The Buddha, he who has taught how to cut off every bond and how to subsist without support, must not become a bond and a support. With regard to the boundary that separates vision from mental expression, and to the consequent necessity of an act starting from within, we find in Zen some episodes that are downright drastic. A disciple who finally asked his master to reveal to him the fundamental principle of the Buddhist doctrine is sent to another master. The question is repeated, and the answer is a slap in the face. Referring the matter to his first master, the disciple is again sent to the second. He asks the same question and the answer is no different, a slap in the face. He is sent a third time. This time the disciple, as soon as he is in the presence of the master, without a word, himself gives the other a blow on the face. The master, smiling, then tells him, "You have understood." Another Zen master told a prince who was debating with him, "We ask nothing of the Buddha, of the law, or of the order." The prince then says, "If you ask nothing of the Buddha, of the law, or of the order, what, then, is the aim of your cult?" Here, again, the answer is simply a slap in the face. The Zen texts are rich in anecdotes where the impulse to know intellectually is cut off by an answer that is entirely out of key, or by a brusque action by the master. They are answers or actions, however, that sometimes act in a mature spirit as a catharsis. They may suddenly confront you with an empty chasm into which you must jump, leaving everything behind, yourself, your own mind, your theories, even your own preoccupation with liberation. A man, wishing to be initiated into the knowledge, knocks at the door of a Zen monastery. The only answer he gets is that the door is shut so brutally in his face that one of his arms is broken. In that instant, illumination flashes over the man. "What is the sacred temple of the Buddha?" asks another. The Zen master replies, "An innocent girl." "And who is the lord of the temple?" "A child in her womb." "What is the true body of the Vairochana Buddha?" The master replies, "Fetch me a jug of water." The disciple does so. The master says, "Take it back to where it was." And this is all. An assembly was called together to hear a lecture, long anticipated, on the essence of the doctrine. The master finally appears and, without speaking, stretches out his arms. This leads us on to another Zen theme, the tongue of the inanimate. These are Siganishin's words, "Before a man studies Zen, for him mountains are mountains and waters are waters." When, thanks to the teaching of a qualified master, he has 225 attained the inner vision of the truth of Zen, for him mountains are no longer mountains and waters are no longer waters. But after this, when he has really reached the haven of calm, once again mountains are, for him, mountains and waters, waters. The second phase evidently corresponds to Nirvana when it is faced by Samsara, the third, to Nirvana that leaves no residue. The return must be interpreted on the lines of the liberated experience, where every dualism is resolved, which we discussed in connection with the Mahayana doctrine of the void and of the Tathat. Zen, however, tends to make nature itself suggest this disindividualized and liberated experience, and to produce moments of illumination such as give a sense of the change of state, in which lies the essence of the path. The mind must come to feel that everything becomes manifest and reveals itself according to an absolute and unparalleled perfection, only then will it have intimations. Also of that Nirvana that leaves nothing behind it, and that corresponds to the mountains. that are once again mountains, and to the waters that are once more waters. One simile, in this connection, is quite expressive. The shadow follows the body, the echo arises from the voice. He who chases his shadow tires his body, not knowing that it is the body that produces the shadow, and he who raises his voice to drown an echo, does not know that the voice is the cause of the echo. It is also said, the subject achieves calm when the object vanishes when the subject achieves calm. Lao Tzu had already taught, abandon in order to obtain. It is a question of creating a state of absolute identity with oneself, without signs, without intentions. Thus, Zen, following the steps of Taoism, speaks of an act that is a non-effort or a non-intention, anapogkei, and of a corresponding resolution, like a vow, anapogpranidna. Another saying, as two flawless mirrors reflect, one in the other, so the concrete fact and the spirit must face each other without any foreign body being interposed. Once again, it is a matter of catharsis from subjectivity, of destruction of psychology, which had already been the aim of the Yathbhutam of ancient Buddhism, the transparent vision conforming to reality. Then nature, in its liberty and impersonality, in its extraneousness to all that is subjective and effective, is able to intimate the state of illumination. This is why Zen declares that the doctrine is found in simple and natural facts rather than in the texts of the canon, and that the universe is its real scripture and the body of the Tathagata. Trees, grass, mountains, streams, stars, the sea, the moon, with this alphabet the texts of Zen are written. Can the inanimate preach the doctrine? Huicheng replies, yes, it preaches with eloquent words and without ceasing. The sun rises. The moon sets. Mountain heights. Ocean depths. Spring flowers. Fresh summer breeze. The large autumnal moon. Winter. Snowflakes. These things, perhaps too simple for a common observer to pay them attention, have a deep meaning for Zen. What is the truth? Asks a disciple. As a reply, the master Yoshan indicates the sky with his finger and then a pitcher of water and says, do you see? 226. The other says, no. Yoshan replies, the cloud in the sky and the water in the pitcher, that is all. Tungsha says, how wonderful is the tongue of the inanimate. You cannot hear it with your ears, but you can hear it with your eyes, with the unclosed eye of the mind, not through perception, not with logic, not with metaphysics. Another saying of Zen, the leaves that fall, like the flowers that open, reveal for us the blessed law of the Buddha. We must, however, be very careful not to confuse all this with aestheticism sui generis. The Far Eastern simplified and particularly transparent feeling for nature plays its part, as we have said. But the fundamental point is to go up from nature, which is free from soul and is only itself, free from effects and subjectivity, to the perception where, in fact, mountains are again mountains and waters, waters. A Zen formula, which in some way sums up its doctrine, is, reflect in yourself and recognize your own face as it was before the world, Huineng. Together with the message of the inanimate, there is a manner in which signs, gestures, and symbols take the place of words. We have already mentioned the master of Zen who, before the assembly of monks collected to hear his discourse, confined himself to stretching his arms. Another simply raises his finger. Another presents a stick. It is said that Markasapa was chosen by the Buddha for the transmission of the esoteric doctrine in similar circumstances. The Buddha, in the midst of his disciples, had raised a bunch of flowers into the air. Only Markasapa among those present had smiled and inclined his head in assent. Words limit. A sign can, however, at a suitable time, cause moments of illumination. From these antecedents, it is not difficult to understand that Zen insists above all on a spiritual awakening, or change of inner state, that is sudden and discontinuous. The opening of the third eye. Satori, illumination, is a condition that happens suddenly, destroying all that has gone before, appearing to be without origin, without becoming. The theme of the Vajracchedic is echoed in Zen. The Tathagata is so called because he does not come from anywhere and does not go anywhere. When he appears, he comes from nowhere, and when he disappears, he goes nowhere, and this is Zen. And again, where there really is a coming in or a going out, their great contemplation is not. Zen, the contemplative state, the state of illumination awakening, in its essence, is without birth. At one period, nevertheless, Zen became divided into two different schools, that of the South, Yugapad, which lays greater emphasis on the discontinuity of the awakening, and that of the North, Kramavritya, which, instead, allows of a certain gradualness. But both agree that it is essential, at a particular moment, to know how to jump out of the I, how to vomit forth the F. This may be brought about also by violent sensations, even by a physical pain, by something, according to a Chinese saying, that twists the bowels 9 times and more. We have already told of the 227 episode of the broken arm, and there are many like it. It seems that, in some places at the present time, an operation not unlike strangulation is carried out, by means of which the disciple, who is suitably prepared, is forced forward toward a void into which he cannot but jump. As for preparation, the methods of Zen do not differ essentially from what we have already described as Ariyang Asesis. First, make oneself master of external objects by substituting a condition of activity for the usual one of passivity. Realize that wherever a desire pushes a man toward a thing, it is not he who has the thing, but the thing that has him. He who takes a liquor believes that he drinks it, whereas it is the liquor that drinks him. Detach oneself. Discover and love the active principle in oneself. Second is mastery of the body. Establish one's own authority over the entire organism. Imagine that your body is separate from you. If it shouts, make it be silent, as a severe father does his child. If it shows temper, hold it in, as one does a curbed horse. If it is ill, administer to it what is necessary, as a doctor to his patient. If it disobeys, chastise it, as the master chastises the turbulent pupil. Temper oneself physically. Establish with oneself a trial of endurance by accustoming oneself, for example, to undergoing freezing cold in winter and in summer a torrid heat. And so on. Third is the control of mental and emotive life in order to promote and consolidate a state of equilibrium. There is the appeal to one's inner ability. It is ridiculous, it is said in Zen, that a being endowed with the nature of a Buddha, born to be master of every material reality, should be enslaved by little cares or frightened by phantasms that he himself has created, should let his mind be swayed by passions or dissipate his vital energy in irrelevant things. Anxieties, recriminations, or nostalgias for the past, imaginings or anticipations for the future, enmity, shame, and disturbance, all these must be put aside. One may help oneself, eventually, by means of the idealistic theory, compare to p. 223, which may help one to realize the irrationality of so many of the mind's impulses, and to regaining power over one's heart. Furthermore, one must simplify oneself, one must resolutely cut down the parasitical overgrowth of vain and muddled thoughts. To the question, how shall I learn the law, the Zen master, Po Chang, replied, eat when you are hungry and sleep when you are tired. Calm and equilibrium, the samatha that we have frequently mentioned, must become a habit. Here is an anecdote. When commanding an army in battle, even in his headquarters, Oyomai would discuss Zen doctrines. He was informed, on one occasion, that his advance troops had been defeated. He calmly continued his discourse. Shortly after, he was told that, in the later development of the battle, he had become the victor. The commander remained as calm as before, and did not, even then, change his discourse. This is how one gradually apprehends the existence. 228. Of a principle that cannot be altered by doubt or fear any more than the light of the sun can be destroyed by fog or clouds. Fourth, when we come to the aforesaid throwing out of the mind, or of the eye, we find that we are here faced with some sort of discontinuity for which there is no means of preparing, because it is an actual change of state. To one who was astonished at the saying, that the world enters into the mind, a Zen master replied saying that the difficulty consists, rather, in making the mind enter into the world. It is a matter of the breaking of the shell constituted by the mind, of which a Mahayana text we have already quoted, speaks, only then does one have the intuition that nirvana, when understood as one term of an opposition, is itself an illusion, a bond, the object of an imperfect knowledge. Zen uses a twofold symbolism for the structure of its discipline, that of the 5 degrees of merit, and that of the vicissitudes of the man and the hull. The first degree of merit corresponds to the conversion, similar to Pabaj, the departure of the ancient Buddhist teaching, a man turns from the outer world toward the inner world. The illuminated, extrasamsaric eye is here portrayed as a king to whom one declares allegiance. The second degree of merit is service, that is to say, faithfulness and loyalty to this inner sovereign. The third degree is valor, what one must show when confronting and combating all opposition to the king. Then there is the merit of him who cooperates, due to one who is not simply good at defense and fighting, but who is admitted to the positive government of the state. The final degree of merit, beyond merit or merit that is not merit, an expression to be understood in the same sense as acting without acting, is the degree of the king himself, whose nature one assumes. Here action ceases or, if you prefer, action is manifested in the form of non-action, of spontaneity. The being and the law are here identical. And now the second Zen symbolism, made up of 10 well-known illustrations corresponding to 10 episodes in the adventures of a drover and a hull. The mind, represented in the preceding allegory, by the king, or rather, illumination, the body element, is conceived as a precious stone, always fresh and pure, even when buried in dust. It has to be found as the drover seeks a ball. The first figure is, in fact, uncertain search. The second is hope, the animal has not yet been seen, but its tracks have been sighted. Third, the hull is seen in the distance, and a cautious advance toward it is made. Fourth, the animal is suddenly seized, and it tries in vain to escape. Fifth, the animal is tamed, mastered, and fed, so that finally it follows the drover as if it were his shadow. Sixth, the drover is carried home by this animal that serves him as a mount. Seventh, the forgetting of the animal and the remembering of the man. Eighth, the forgetting both of the bull and of the man. The corresponding figure gives only a large empty circle. We are at the point of overcoming all dualism in the 229 void, in liberated consciousness. Ninth, return to the origins and to the source. We remember the Zen saying, rediscover your own face as it was before the world. Last figure, going into the town with the hands open, this face should he compared with that in which, once again, mountains are mountains and waters, waters. It is the point at which transcendency becomes the clarity of an immanence that is free from the stain of the eye. It is the state in which there is nothing that comes or goes, that enters or leaves. As a corollary of this, some Zen masters have declared that self-application and self-concentration and the seeking of solitary and silent places belong to the heterodox teachings. Do not he attach to anything whatsoever. If you understand this, walking or standing, sitting or lying, you will never cease to be in the state of Zen, in the state of contemplation and of illumination. The Zen masters teach that the blessed order of the ancient Arya, seated round Prince Siddhartha, is even now gathered at the vulture's peak, that is to say, at the symbolical place where, in the Mahayana texts, the awakened one is supposed most frequently to have spoken, and that expresses the traditional idea of the center, that center of the world. 230. 19. The Arya are still gathered on the vulture's peak. In this book, we have not set out to make Buddhist propaganda, but, rather, as we said, to indicate the fundamental elements of a complete system of ascesis. These elements may be found in other traditions also, but they appear with particular clarity in the Buddhist teaching, which lends itself admirably to our purpose for the various reasons that we discussed at the beginning. It now remains to suggest the significance that an ascesis of this sort may have at the present day. We need hardly stress the fact that the modern world stands, more completely so perhaps than in any other civilization, at the opposite pole to that of an ascetic view of life. We are not talking here of the religious problem that, as we have seen, has no direct relationship to higher ascesis. We are speaking of fundamental orientations of the spirit. It would be hard to deny that activism, the exaltation and practice of action, understood as force, impetus, becoming, struggle, transformation, perennial research, or ceaseless movement, is the watchword of the modern world. The world of the being is drawing to its close, and this decline has for long been hailed with joy. Not only do we have today the triumph of activism, but also a philosophy sui generis at its service, a philosophy whose systematic criticism and whose speculative apparatus serve to justify it in every way while pouring contempt and heaping discredit on all other points of view. Interest in pure knowledge has become ever more displaced by interest in living and in doing, or, at any rate, by interest in those departments of knowledge that can be employed in terms of action or practical and temporal realization. Today, the nature and potentialities of pure knowledge, that is to say, knowledge whose peculiar object, as in the traditional ideal of all periods, is super-individual and super-historical reality, is almost unknown. Our contemporaries grow ever 231.